This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 33. It's been a big week here at Pure Green as we made a major announcement sharing that we would no longer be producing the magazine in print. For more about our reasons for doing that, I encourage you to visit puregreenmag.com/evolution. There's a personal message from me there explaining it all. I have to say, however, that I'm blown away by the Pure Green community. The support our readers have shown us during this transition has been nothing short of incredible. My heart is full of gratitude, and you have made it all so much easier. You should also know that we're having a super sale on all back issues. These are limited editions, folks, now an endangered species, if you will, and I desperately want you to claim one or two or the whole set as your own. Go to puregreenmag.com to check it out, and please know that we're not going anywhere. We're simply shifting our focus online and have some amazing things coming up, so stay tuned. Okay, so on to this week's episode. One thing I love about hosting this podcast is that so often it feels like I'm talking to an old friend. This episode is no exception, and I'm thrilled you get to meet her too. I'm talking with Sasha Swerdlov, a blogger, photographer, and recipe developer who pens a beautiful blog called Tending the Table. Sasha's blog has a lovely personal style. Her caring voice truly speaks through, as does her love for the outdoors and her respect for the planet. Her plant-based recipes are delicious and inspiring, so much so that we asked her to be a community leader for our in-season collaborative cookbook project. In this episode, we talk about food, of course, and blogging too, but also the roots of Sasha's stewardship of the environment, beginning with her childhood raised on a farm in Oregon. We talk about her immersion into yoga, how she followed her passion to India, and the role that yoga has now in her home practice. We even talk about her recent trip to an ocean conservation conference, the issues that were discussed there, and a few things we might do about some of those things, and also how to find nature in an urban setting. It's a great episode. Let's dive in. Here's Sasha.
So, Sasha, thank you so much for coming on today and for talking with me. I'm really excited to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So, I wanted to rewind a little bit to your childhood. You grew up in the wilds of Oregon, which is where I would imagine your love of nature stems from. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your experience growing up there and what you would say are the greatest life lessons you took away from growing up that way on a farm and connected with nature.
Yeah. Well, I was really lucky to grow up on a large piece of land, really in the middle of nowhere. And my mom had several gardens and still does, and we had chickens and horses and rabbits. But aside from all of the gardening and preserving, I think the biggest thing was that we took a lot of walks in the woods. And my stepdad taught me, you know, all of the edibles in the woods. So as a kid, he made those walks really, really fun and into little adventures for me. And so I feel really grateful that I learned to sort of recognize that there's food all around us if we know where to look. And I carry that into my life. You know, when I go hiking or backpacking, I really enjoy being able to pick out, oh, look, there is that plant, or, you know, we can eat that, or and I'd love to learn more. But I think that really tied together nature and food for me, and this appreciation for nature and all that it provides.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really wonderful. So horses, mm-hmm. did you ride?
I did. I did 4-H in high school. So, and I was on the equestrian team. So did a more Western okay. than English. So like gaming and like pole bending, barrel racing, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Horses have always been a passion of mine. I grew up around them too. I got my first horse when I was 13.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. I grew up with them. My mom had always wanted horses, so she got them. And then I started riding them, and she actually just got a baby horse last year, so she's doing that whole thing now. But now, when I go home, I'm like a little more scared of the horses than I used to be for some reason. I think just I'm out of practice, or I don't know.
Things you do when you're a kid and you have zero fear.
Yeah.
Like, remember, I would take my horse, which at that time, I would never do that with the horse I have now, but I used to take him out into the field, and I would just sit on him bareback while he grass, and I that if you sit on your horse backwards, and you their back, like the slope of their back, and their big old butt makes like a perfect pillow, and I would just hang out.
Yeah, I used to do that while we were moving. We would spin around and like, oh, let's see how long I can ride backwards for.
Yeah, exactly. And I would never do that now. So, I love as well that you were taught about edibles in the forest. I mean, walking in the forest was a huge part of my childhood too, and it's still a part of my life. And I know it's a part of yours too.
Yeah.
And always, like, I see little things around, but I'm a little hesitant. Like, outside of leeks and fiddleheads, those are the only two I feel really comfortable picking. But it's something I've always wanted to learn more about as well.
Yeah.
So now, would you consider yourself an environmentalist?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define environmentalist. I feel like that's a dangerous word. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's easy for me to care about the environment because of my childhood and growing up the way that I did. But I don't know if I would label myself an environmentalist. I think a lot of my interest in living sustainably or my care for the natural world comes from my yoga practice as well, and understanding the yamas and niyamas, and that one of those is nonviolence, and it's important to not only be nonviolent towards other humans but towards the planet as well. So that's part of my motivation, I guess. But I also, I don't know that I feel, I feel that it's important to help others see what they might need to change, but I often get very disillusioned and return to this idea that the only way to change the world is to change ourselves. And so I try to just focus on me and what I can do better.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I love your answer, because it's, you know, I wanted to ask you that because when I read your blog and the approach that you take and the words that you choose, to me, just indicate this respect and love for the earth and the planet and the things that come from it, the food and all of that. And so I was curious what your personal position was on living a conscious lifestyle. And I didn't know that. You don't talk very much about yoga on your blog.
I don't think. Kind of intentionally, actually. When we first moved to Seattle, I thought about teaching yoga here briefly and doing Ayurvedic consultations. But I had a really hard time, setting up a website and promoting myself, because it felt like counterintuitive to my yoga practice. And I don't know, I'm just not super comfortable promoting that. I think of it so much as a personal practice that it's sort of my thing that is just for me.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's interesting because when I watch what goes on in the yoga world, and I'm very much an outsider looking in, and my only exposure to that bigger part of it is just online, basically. Mm-hmm. So, media. And it seems like it's, even though it is an inward practice, there's a big, huge part of it that's an outward thing. Mm-hmm. And so I hear what you're saying, and I applaud you for that. And I've been considering doing my yoga teacher training, but the only reason I want to is to deepen my own understanding of it. I feel like that's the only way to dive in really deep. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to do it because it involves teaching.
Yeah.
Like a right.
Yeah, and maintaining a certain number of hours each year and all of that.
It's the education that I'm really wanting to do. But
you could certainly just do it for yourself without the expectation that you would teach.
That would definitely be my plan. But I think as part of it, you do have to do a little.
Part of the training, yeah.
At what point in your life did yoga take on an important role?
Well, I had always been interested But I hadn't really found the right style of yoga for me. And when I went to college in Vermont, my now husband and I had a friend who said, oh, there's this great yoga teacher in this town nearby. You should come with me. She has this great special, 30 days for $30. So we went with a couple other friends and signed up for the summer. And then we were like, we're going to get our money's worth. So we went every day. And then it just clicked. It was, I mean, our teacher, Christine Hoare, has since moved from Vermont to Montauk and still teaches there, but she's pretty special. So we really connected with her and with Ashtanga yoga. And yeah, we practiced there every day for 4 years or so.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and then we, after I graduated, we went to Thailand, and then we went to India to practice there for 3 months. So it's, since moving to Seattle, it's become a little bit less a part of my life, which makes me sad, but I think just not having that strong community has made it harder for me and really made me appreciate the strength that it takes to have that personal home practice. You know, not having the motivation, you know, of going to a class and knowing that there will be other people there doing this practice and having to get up and say, okay, I'm going to do this. There's no one else here telling me to. But that's been a challenge for me the last couple of years.
I struggle with that too. But I don't have nearly the footing that you do. That sounds wonderful. So what was it like to go to India for 3 months to did you go to travel or did you go specifically to pursue?
We went specifically to practice yoga. The founder of Ashtanga Yoga has a shala there. His grandson now runs, and we went specifically to practice there with him. We rented an apartment, and that was our life for 3 months. We would get up at 4:30 and go do our practice, drink a bunch of coconut water afterwards, and walk home, have breakfast, and yeah, we were home by, 6:30 or 7:00, and then the rest of the day was just hanging out, going out to a cafe to eat. You know, we had a little motorbike. We would scooter around the city and check things out. But yeah, the goal was just to practice there and deepen our practice, and not just physically. I mean, there was chanting twice a week at the shala, and some other classes that were taught, and Sunday conference where the teacher would talk about, different topics in terms of yoga philosophy. And so it was really, really wonderful.
Yeah. What region of India was it in?
It was in Mysore. So it's sort of southern. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it beautiful there?
You know, we didn't really go outside of Mysore, mostly because we had this early morning practice, so we couldn't, go do an overnight somewhere. So I don't feel like I really saw much of the landscape. I mean, the neighborhood we were in was also a wealthier neighborhood that was, had built up a little bit around this yoga shala and was tailored towards Westerners a little bit. So I don't know that I really got a very authentic India experience, whatever that means, because it was so much just about the practice. And I would love to go back and travel around a little bit more.
Yeah, it's one of those places I've always wanted to go, but at the same time, I'm a little scared to go because I've heard stories, the experiences of others about the density of the population and the garbage, and it's hard to deal with as well.
Yeah.
But still, it's such a culturally rich place. Mm-hmm. I think it would be. I've heard that if you go outside of the cities and more in the surrounding areas, in the countryside and further afield, it's just stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is probably a big complicated question, but what would you say are the main things that you took away from your time spent there studying?
Oh boy. I think the biggest thing that I learned while I was there was about my relationship with fear and how I sort of respond to fear. And so a lot of my time there was spent trying to overcome that. And that manifested in, you know, the physical practice, you know, doing drop back. So doing a back bend from standing up was very scary for me, but every day I had to try and try again and try again. And so, I think that helped me become a little bit stronger and braver, which was good. And I would say the other huge thing that my husband and I both took away was, this idea of carrying, these tenets of the yoga philosophy into your life. And that, you know, it's easy when you're in a room doing yoga to think, oh, I'm going to be nonviolent, or, you know, I'm going to be truthful. But it's a lot harder when you're in an environment that is difficult. And so, especially in India, like you were saying, you know, there's a lot of external things going on around you. And so having to live every day thinking about, you know, how am I living this philosophy? How am I responding to the things around me in the best way possible? So it really forced us to do that. And I'm really grateful for that.
So would you say that have you been successful, I guess I should say, in being able to carry those throughout your life, even though, like, how long ago were you there?
We were there 4 years ago. Yeah. Okay.
4 years later. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel like you're able to do that, or how do you remind yourself?
Well, I think it's easier here, in, you know, in Seattle, but, it's funny you asked that, because while we were in Hawaii, recently, we went up to, one of the volcanoes. You can go up to the crater for sunrise. And I hadn't done this before, and I had in my mind this idyllic, like, nature experience. Oh, we're going to go up for sunrise. We're just going to sit there. It's going to be so peaceful. And we get up there and there's hordes of people. The place is just packed with tourists. And there's all these tour buses that drove up there for sunrise. And everyone's talking and has their, you know, phones out, and they're taking pictures and stepping on all of the, you know, areas where there's endangered insect species, and just, you know, being humans. And, my husband and I were standing there sort of giggling, sort of being a little frustrated. And that was, I had a moment like, okay, like, how am I responding to this? You know, do I respond by getting annoyed and projecting this negative, angry energy towards these people? Or do I, you know, laugh about it and say, hey, they just don't know any better? Or, you know, what's the best way for me to respond to this situation? So it's those kinds of things where you have to just sort of pause and think about it before you react. And I think it's similar with living a sustainable lifestyle. You know, you have to sort of think about it every day before you do something. Oh, am I going to drive? Am I just going to go get in the car and drive somewhere? Or am I going to take a little extra effort and ride my bike? Or, you know, I'm doing the dishes. Am I going to, you know, take the self-control to, I'm really horrible with dishes, to turn the faucet off and, like, wash all the dishes and then rinse all the dishes. So I think it really just comes down to that, being patient with yourself and, you know, pausing, thinking before you act.
Well, being able to step away from a situation too, and from your own immediate emotional reaction too, able to, that's hard to do. But that's also, that's what I love about yoga, and also what I love about living consciously, because those are the things that happen. And after a while, it's not even hard. It's just a reflex.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I mean, it comes with a certain degree of frustration too, because you wonder why others, you know, are so oblivious sometimes.
Right.
But, or the world in terms of sustainable living, but it feels so good and so natural to me, to you. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, you know, I want to switch over to your approach to sustainable living as well. And you had sort of said it's about making those decisions on a daily basis, which I think is very true. Mm-hmm. So do you think that your life has always been moving in that direction, or do you remember a time when you realized that it was a way that you wanted to start living?
Well, growing up, I was thinking about this the other day. Growing up, my mom drove probably 4 hours a day to get me to and from school. Not the most sustainable decision, because the school where we lived was not a very good school, a really small town. And so she drove me into Portland every morning and then drove home and then drove in again in the afternoon to pick me up. And then we drove home. So even though, you know, I grew up on this farm with all these gardens and learning about nature, there were definitely some things that, you know, as a family, we didn't do very sustainably. But I think when I got to college, I was exposed to a lot more people making a really big effort to live more consciously. And my husband particularly still is a huge inspiration for me. And, you know, he's the one who's constantly reminding me, oh, maybe we should hang up the clothes today instead of stick them in the dryer. Hey, maybe we should, you know, not drive today. Or so, I don't know. I think it's, I don't think there's a certain point in time when I decided that I was going to live a certain way. I do think that having people in my life who helped me and continue to help me think about things on a daily basis, is really, really what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely about checks and balances. I mean, for everybody, mm-hmm. because like you said, you were doing all these wonderful things and gardening and living close to the earth, which is super sustainable. And then you were driving. And so, I mean, no one can be perfect,
right.
unless that's almost something they strive towards, I guess. And it's very stringent
mm-hmm.
and limiting in a way. So it's just about choosing something and mastering that and creating new habits around that one thing and then moving on and doing the same thing again until eventually you've got a decent part of your life covered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it's the same thing. I live in a rural area, and so I do drive, and I hate that. I wish I could bike, but we also live in a cold climate.
Right.
Snow for half the year, and it's a considerable distance. It's just not realistic.
Yeah.
So, And so, what were some of the changes that you remember making early on, and what are some changes in terms of green living that you're looking to make in the near future?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how early on this changed, really, but I guess it was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. Well, I guess when we started practicing yoga, a lot of things shifted just in terms of diet, and that was more for, yoga reasons than really thinking about it as an environmental decision. But the two often go hand in hand. And then I read Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer, and that really did it for me in terms of, choosing or not choosing to eat animal products. So since reading that, we don't really buy any animal products unless I know exactly where it came from. And in Vermont, we were super lucky to live with a family who had chickens and a cow and raised their own pigs. And I felt okay eating those animal products because I knew exactly where they came from, and I saw those animals out in the pasture every day, and I knew that they were loved and, they were killed in the most humane way possible. And, but now, I mean, it's a lot harder in a city to really know where your food comes from. So we just sort of avoid it. I mean, we have our own chickens and, but other than those eggs, we don't really buy many animal products. So I guess that was a big shift, that happened a few years ago and is still really important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way about meat, and that's sort of the same compromise that I make.
Yeah.
and it works out.
It
works well. And so you have chickens. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
How long have you had them?
Just a couple years since we moved to Seattle. Because I grew up with chickens, and then in Vermont, we were around them, and we were moving to the city, and I was like, hey, I think we can have chickens. I want to do that. So we had six for a year, and one of them kept escaping, so we sent her to my mom's house for retirement. And then one of them got eaten by a raccoon, and the other one mysteriously died. So we now have three, which it's, you know, it's sad, but it was also this realization for me when that one got eaten by a raccoon or the other one died, like, oh, wow, this is like farm life. Like, it's a real thing. Like, you know, the reality of an animal dying in front of you is a lot different than just thinking about it in your head. And made me appreciate, you know, those eggs and chicken so much more when you're confronted by that reality.
Yeah, I mean, animal husbandry is a difficult, often thing, and it's also it's a reminder, I guess, that even in a city, this, you know, like the cycle of life and the interaction of nature is still happening.
Yeah. Yep.
So you have three chickens now. Mm-hmm. Would you say, I've always been curious about that. I've asked a few people about it now, but just what it's like to raise chickens in a city. Do you have any problems with the city or with your neighbors or how much it?
Some of our neighbors don't love the chickens just because in the morning they make a little noise and because they were escaping for a little while. And I do feel like they're not living the best life possible. I mean, we tried to let them sort of free range in the backyard for a little while, and our yard is way too small, and they just, you know, destroyed all the plants in, you know, a day or two. So they have, you know, a pretty sizable run along the whole length of the house, but, you know, they're not running around in the grass. They're not eating bugs. And I do feel like it's not the optimal life for them. I think, you know, as far as I can tell, they're pretty happy, but, you know, I've seen how my mom's chickens are raised, and I know that they could be happier if they were running around in a field. But I do, you know, we try to do our best to also think about the whole system when it comes to the chickens. And, my husband's really, really passionate about ocean, conservation, and, read a while back about, chicken food being made up of fish meal that's not necessarily sustainably harvested. And so we started making our own chicken food. So we buy bulk bags of organic grains and seeds and mix it up for them. And generally they like that. So that feels pretty good. And yeah, and it feels good to not have to buy eggs from, you know, a large producer.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I have not been successful convincing my husband to let him. But I think, you know, it's just, we're too busy, maybe. Yeah. It's just a stress we don't need. And so I'm feeling really lucky. I think I have the best situation possible in my scenario, that there's a farmer that we have that sends us eggs, more eggs than we can eat. You know, we're really well supplied in terms of farm fresh eggs. And I love opening it up every week, the dozen, the carton of eggs, and seeing like all the, you know, the different shapes and colors. Speckling, and it just looks so real and so organic. I love that. So would you, once these chickens are gone, would you do it again? Would you keep doing it?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We were thinking about that because they're about a year and a half old now, and that's when they start to taper off their egg laying. And so we were thinking about, oh, it's about time to get some new chicks for, you know, next year. And I started looking into where to get them, and even the little farm stores here or in Portland that have a lot of sustainable products or organic feed or things like that, all of their chicks come from these giant factories in Texas, and they're, you know, shipped out to these stores. And I didn't really feel very good about that. So we borrowed an incubator from a friend, and my mom had a rooster. So we got some eggs from what we thought would be fertilized eggs from her hens, but we only had one of them hatch, so I think we're going to keep trying to do that. I don't know, until I find another alternative to get some chicks that were not from a giant hatchery.
Yeah, I think that people often forget that part of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And you for taking that route. That's daunting to me.
My mom, I mean, the incubator's at her house, so she's the one having to deal with it. But
so you had one hatch.
Yeah, and I think it's a rooster, too.
Oh, shoot.
But.
So I wanted to move on as well and ask you about, because you mentioned it, you brought it up, and it's good. I wanted to ask you about it anyway, about ocean conservation. It's something that I'm hugely passionate about, too. Even though where I live, I'm nowhere near the coast. But I think that it's one of the bigger problems facing us, and it's dense and serious, and it's connected to everything. So I know that this past spring you attended a conference at the Sustainable Foods Institute hosted by the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which are also the ones that released the Sustainable Seafood Guide, I think, right?
Yep, Seafood Watch.
Yeah. So did you go because of your husband? He was interested in that?
No, I actually went because my husband and I are on the board for a charitable foundation, and the Monterey Bay Aquarium is one of the groups that we support. So they invited us to come to this conference because they knew that I was particularly interested in food and sustainability. So, yeah, we were very lucky to go. It's mostly it's designed for media, so they have lots of journalists there and not a lot of, you know, people from foundations or just average people interested in the topics. So I felt really lucky to be invited, and it was really amazing. 2 days of lectures and panels about a wide variety of topics relating to food sustainability.
So what were some of the main, like, memorable themes that you took away from it?
Yeah. One thing I'm really passionate about is food waste. So there was a whole panel on that topic, and that was really inspiring to see the different organizations who are doing work in that area. But it was also really interesting for me to learn that the number one place that food goes to waste is actually on the farm, because it, you know, drops from the tree, or it's not perfect, or it's not exactly the right size. And that was really kind of difficult for me to learn, that there's all of this perfectly good food that hasn't even made it to the grocery store or someone's home, and it's just rotting on the ground because it doesn't fit our idea of what an apple should look like. So there's some organizations who are, I guess Bon Appetit has a campaign called Imperfectly Delicious, and they're trying to make these imperfect fruits and vegetables appealing to people again. And it's such a cultural and societal thing, this expectation that our produce should look a certain way. So I think it's really great that they're sort of trying to change that. So the food waste panel was really, really inspiring.
That's amazing. So there's organizations trying to educate so that we can change the expectation. Is that the main thing that's sort of being done around that?
There's a lot of, there were several other organizations who were on the panel who are working on collecting food waste. One in San Francisco, I don't remember the name, but they've worked out a system where they actually are able to collect food waste from restaurants now and then redistribute it, which is pretty wonderful, I think, because so much food goes to waste in restaurants. And I'm not exactly sure what the guidelines are for making that work, but yeah, they're doing that. And then another organization is working with college campuses, educating and collecting food waste there. So there's a lot of people doing different things.
So great. And I mean, I often wonder about that. Every week I go to the farmer's market and I look at this beautiful produce and I wonder what happens to it if it doesn't sell, or like whichever, you know. And it's true, I visited the Scotland quite some time ago now, like I forget how many years, but anyway, and they have a different guideline there for produce, and they allow in all of that, I wouldn't say blemished fruit, but just the fruit that's not all uniform in color and shape and size and all that stuff, and it might be spotted or it might be whatever, right? And that was really noticeable, and I loved that was part of it. of their policy, and I wondered why that it was such an issue here. And then since then, I've learned like you said, there's a bunch of ones doing it, and I can't remember the name either, but I know there's one in Chicago that's doing work around that as well. But I was reading through them that, and I'll try and look this up later, but where they were saying that grocery stores also, like, we just like to see lots, mm-hmm. like any like fruits in yeah. one display. And so there's a lot of waste as well, just for that one reason, because the aesthetic of having many of the same thing looks better than having a
yeah,
few.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. So food waste, and was there anything else?
Yeah. One of the other panels that I really thought was interesting was with a nutritionist from Stanford, and there were a couple other people on the panel, but he mostly was talking about protein, and that Americans eat twice as much protein as we actually need, and that that's a huge contributor to environmental issues, and that if we actually ate the recommended daily allowance and ate mostly, you know, plant-based protein, you know, we could reduce the environmental impact enormously. So that was really interesting to hear and to think about, this fascination in our culture with getting enough protein, and that, you know, we don't really need to worry about it, that all of the plants have protein. You know, we can get protein from other sources than animal products. And I don't know. I don't exactly know how that translates into, you know, a message that people will resonate with, but I think it's an important thing to try to communicate to people and spread the word about.
I agree. I mean, it's a criticism that you often hear about being vegetarian or whatever.
Right.
People get really stuff about it, even your doctor or whatever.
Right, right.
But, yeah, I hadn't really thought of it all that much, but it's true, and it would definitely, I mean, our meat industry is such a big deal. It's a huge strain on the environment. So if we could cut that back, that would make a really big difference.
Yeah. And I mean, since this conference, I was just reading an article the other day about the Seafood Watch program, those pamphlets, and the idea that, you know, that's one thing that's actually changing the market, and that more and more to me, that seems like the most effective way to really change things on a large scale is if we can somehow affect the market and, you know, change consumer demand or change what's available to consumers. And, I don't know, that's like so beyond my realm or my expertise, but it does seem like a really powerful way to change things quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something I've believed for a really long time. And I mean, you, every time you buy something, you vote
yeah.
with your dollars.
Yeah.
And it's the truly, I mean, like, we're a capitalist society that, I mean, that's how we run. And if there's no demand for it, we'll stop making it.
Yeah.
So, but it's also, I mean, it's a tricky thing to think that way sometimes, because you can get really mired down in the logistics of mm-hmm. it. You're like, well, such a big process, like so many people have to do this, and you know, and
yeah.
But I just try and remind myself that if I don't do it, and then I talk to my sister about it, or I talk to my mom or my friend or whoever, or they talk to me about it, like it all has an effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's all important work.
Yeah.
So gosh, I could talk to you about all of this forever, but I wanted to move on to your blog
yeah.
a little bit. It's a regular favorite of mine since
you
first introduced me to it. It's really well done. So, you know, I wanted to ask you about the relationship between food and sustainability, but I think we've talked about that a little bit already. So I wanted to ask you why did you start your blog in the first place, and how did you establish your voice and grow it?
Yeah. Well, for several years after college, I was sort of floundering, trying to figure out what I actually wanted to do and feeling pretty lost. And I've always been interested in food, but I knew that I didn't want to work in a restaurant or do catering or any of those things. And we moved to Seattle, and I was sort of transplanted from my community in Vermont and struggling with these you know, not knowing what to do. And my husband said, oh, why don't you just like find some classes, find some things that you think you might be interested in and take some classes just for fun with no expectation or pressure. And so I signed up for this food styling and photography workshop here in Seattle. And the day after that, I started the blog.
So it obviously made an impact on you.
Yeah, I mean, and I had never been a photographer. My husband studied photography in college. My stepdad's a photographer, so I was surrounded by it. But that was sort of the new and maybe the missing piece for me. You know, I had always been interested in food and cooking, and that's all very comfortable for me. But the photography has definitely been the biggest challenge, and I've learned the most in that area.
Yeah, it seems like you're figuring it out, though.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So is blogging what you do full-time now, or do you have other work as well?
Yeah, I do the blog. I cook for a couple families here in Seattle twice a week, and I host these benefit brunches every couple months. That the idea is from a place in Ann Arbor called Selma's. And I choose an organization to donate to, and I plan a menu, and people donate for the meal, and the proceeds all go to an organization that's doing some sort of work in, you know, sustainable local food. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are sort of the three things that I'm doing right now, and yeah.
That sounds amazing. So what is your creative process like then in the kitchen?
Well, I usually just start with sort of an ingredient or an idea and go from there. And I spend a lot of time just thinking about flavors and textures before I even actually start cooking, which I think is one of my strong points, is that I've been exposed to a lot of different food and a lot of different flavors and ingredients, and so I can sort of imagine what those things will taste like pretty well. So then once I start cooking, it's really just a matter of, you know, ratios and tasting. And I usually, you know, will spend a day developing a recipe, cooking, taking pictures, and then editing and posting a photo or several photos. I don't know. Nothing too crazy. I'm still learning for sure. I've sort of set a schedule for myself, which I think helps in the beginning when you're starting to do this, to hold yourself accountable to doing it, you know, once or twice a week, because that's really how you learn and improve. So that's been huge.
I mean, it sounds like it's an organic process for you.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky because you do have that ability to. I mean, my husband Jonathan has that same ability, which I'm starting to slowly develop, but it doesn't come easily.
Yeah.
I mean, to you it does. You're lucky.
Yeah, and I feel like I've been so lucky too to meet so many wonderful people in the food blogging world. And been so impressed with how open and generous people are. It's really, really wonderful. You know, I can reach out to someone who I've never met before. And for the most part, everyone is really willing to share information and offer advice and get together for coffee. And I really appreciate that about this whole blogging world. So that's been really nice too, to feel welcomed and not like everyone's in competition with each other, but that it's more of a community and everyone loves what they're doing and they want to share it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that too. I've been lucky enough to experience the same thing, and it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Even, you know, Sherry last week on our podcast was saying that it can be lonely as well.
Mm-hmm.
To not have these interactions in person, but maybe you are lucky enough to because you're in a city, and so you've got maybe lots, I don't know, maybe it sounds like you had trouble at the beginning sort of establishing your community in Seattle, but I'm sure that's getting a bit better.
It is. I mean, and I'm a little bit of an introvert too, so I don't really mind that I'm working at home by myself all day. I actually kind of like that. But it is a little strange, like having these relationships with people that you've never met It feels like you know them so well, but you've never met them. It's kind of odd.
Yeah, I I know, it is odd. But you're in the same city as Erin of Canel and Vanille.
Yeah, and I just did a workshop with her yesterday. She did a gluten-free baking class near my house. So I just did that, which was really fun.
Yeah, I bet. Sure, it was great.
Yeah.
I've always been hoping to do a course with her one day. I know she did one in Montreal not too long ago, but I wasn't able to go. But she's really awesome.
Yes, she's very inspiring. And there's a lot of other good food bloggers out in this area too. So,
So would you say that it's easy or hard to live a sustainable lifestyle in Seattle? I've always imagined that it would be, like, it's a city, but I've never been there, so I'm not really qualified to speak up to the subject, but it seems to me like it's somewhat connected with nature.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not a city girl. I think just from, you know, growing up in the country, and I went to school in rural Vermont, so the city has been really hard for me. I think people often talk about how easy it is to get outside from Seattle, and generally speaking, you know, we're not that far from all these amazing places, from the Cascades and the Olympics, but the traffic here is so horrible that it's really hard for me to think about, like, getting in the car and driving an hour to go for a hike. I'm so spoiled from my childhood and college. I'm used to, you know, walking out the door. So it's been really hard for me to not be outside as much. And we spent a lot of time this summer in Oregon at my parents' property. And I think also living in a city has sort of forced me to think about my lifestyle more, because there are so many more options. I mean, in Vermont, you know, living, and I'm sure you know this, living somewhere rural, you sort of, you're more isolated. So, you know, if you don't know what to make for dinner, you figure something out because, you know, it's a half hour drive and the grocery store is probably closed. But in Seattle, it's like, there are so many, you know, we can eat out all the time. We can go to the store whenever we want to. There's more things to buy all around us. So I do feel like that has been really good in some ways, but also difficult to sort of teach ourselves to, you know, refrain from constantly buying more things and consuming more things.
So then perhaps, well, will you always stay there? Are you there for your husband's work?
My husband's in graduate school. He's getting his master's. And so we're here for another year and a half. And then the plan is to move back to Vermont, but we'll see what happens. I'm trying not to be attached to the idea.
Like, you never know what life will take.
Exactly.
Yeah. How then do you continue to weave nature and the outdoors into your life despite living in the city? Have you found, like, any way to do that?
Yeah, like I said, we spend a lot of time at my parents' property. And we actually, it's funny, I think that the closest thing I've found is going to the beach. You know, we can go down to the beach in 10 minutes and it feels like you're out in the middle of nowhere because there's this big expanse of ocean. And so I think that's the best alternative for me at the moment, is to do that and sort of get that feeling of being in the wild or alone. And we've done some camping trips here and there. But we're actually going out tomorrow with my husband's parents for 3 or 4 days of backpacking. So that will be really nice.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
So my last question then to you, before we go, and I've really, really enjoyed our talk, Sasha, so thank you. But my last question is, I wanted to ask you what advice you would give others on living a green life while also being gentle to themselves in the process. And the reason I ask it that way is because it's a big part of our message with Pure Green. I'm very careful about the way that we speak about living sustainably so that we do it in a way that feels empowering and positive, not fearful or, you know, doom.
Yeah.
Which I feel like I encounter that too often, which is why I started this in the first place. And try and teach that one person can definitely, definitely make a difference.
Yeah.
So I feel like you and I are similar. in those goals. And so I wanted to ask you what advice you would give to others.
Yeah, I think I often compare it to my yoga practice in that it's a practice and you're not going to be perfect at it in one day. You know, it's a lifetime practice. And so you have to just get up every morning and keep trying and pick something small and, you know, pick that one thing to work on until you've mastered that and then move on to the next. You said something similar to that while we've been talking. And so I think that's something that I try to remind myself. But I also really strongly believe that it's important to continue learning and exposing ourselves to the things that are going on in the world and to be brave enough to face those things. I so often, you know, we'll be talking to someone about, oh, have you seen this documentary or read this article? And they'll say, oh, no, I don't want to. That's too sad. Yeah. And I think that's really unfortunate because how are we going to learn and change if we don't see what's going on around us and really confront the reality of that? So even though it's difficult and, you know, it might be hard for us, I think that's where for me, a lot of the motivation to change comes from that emotional response to things.
Yeah, me too.
And I think it's important for people to have that feeling so that they understand how important it really is. And I don't know how to show people that without making them afraid or, I'm not quite sure. I mean, that's what works for me. And I think it's probably different for everyone, and that people have to find their own way to go about it.
Yeah. Well, I think however you learn or expose yourself to those things, as long as you're doing it. So if watching a documentary is hard, then, you know, read articles or read a book or listen to a radio program or whatever.
Right.
Like, there's lots of different mediums. Because documentaries can be, I mean, they're designed to be shocking, I think,
right.
by nature.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
I hear you. I love that. And it's very much how I strive to be as well, because every time you get comfortable with something, it makes room in your life for a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, for me, one of the biggest catalysts was having a child.
Mm-hmm.
I want this planet to be here the way that it is for me, for her,
yeah.
more than anything. So that's a big, big motivator. And I've noticed as well in my work that it's a big motivator for others too.
Mm-hmm.
So... Sasha, thank you. I really appreciate your time, and I've enjoyed our talk immensely.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So that concludes my talk with Sasha. I hope you enjoyed it, and please bookmark her blog, Tending the Table. It's sure to become a new favorite. As always, we've prepared show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Sasha, and be sure to check out the links to Sasha's in-season feature on Pure Green. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast.